Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. One of the hardest practices to justify in LDS theology is that of polygamy. In fact, there are three Gospel Topics essays devoted to the topic. In our next conversation with Dr. Matt Harris and Dr. Newell Bringhurst, we'll talk about the strengths and weaknesses of these essays and what the church may have done well as what they've left out. Check out our conversation. We've spent a lot of time on the introduction, but I thought that introduction was fascinating, so I kind of wanted to do that. So both of you have written essays. I know Newell has some books out on polygamy. You also have some on blacks. And of course, Matt, you've got some on race. Let's go with polygamy for a minute here. And let's talk about, in fact, polygamy is the only topic that actually has three Gospel Topics essays. I believe, Newell, you wrote about the third one. So could you tell us a little bit about the, kind of the structure of the essays? Because I noticed you all kind of followed a similar structure and then lead us into polygamy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the only topic. It's interesting. It's the only topic that had three essays. The other one that comes close with two essays, of course, is the Book of Mormon, which deals with the DNA, the essay by Murphy, and also the essay by John Charles Duffy on the method and the mode by which the Book of Mormon was written. But it's interesting because Gary Bejera wrote the first of the three essays, which deals with Joseph Smith and the origins of polygamy and critiques the way in which Topics essay on Joseph Smith and polygamy dealt with that issue, and it's a very balanced essay. I must say I think all three of our essays, including George Smith's as well as my own and Gary's, we tried to carefully point out the strengths of the essays, the respective essays, as well as the shortcomings. I mean, like Gary gives credit to the essay for its frankness in pointing out Joseph Smith's pact, controversial nature of marrying younger women, of the polyandry, that is Joseph Smith marrying women who are already married to other men, as well as concealing the practice from Emma Smith, you know, in the early stages, and so he gives. But the thing that he really hits hardest on is the selective use of documents that in writing the Gospel Topics essays, the authors of the Gospel Topics essay downplay sources that are not only unfavorable, but more contemporary to the practice of polygamy during the lifetime of Joseph Smith. Because one of the real problems with documenting Joseph Smith and the practice of polygamy is the lack of contemporary documentation for the time that Joseph Smith lived when polygamy was being practiced. So the great reliance is on secondary sources and the few primary sources that are available concurrent with the time of Joseph Smith tend to be critical, because throughout his ministry, Joseph Smith continually denied that polygamy was being practiced. Say, no, it's not being practiced. It's not being practiced. And so, you know, that was the real trick, is how to handle the documentation. And he gets into the issue of memory and selective use of documentation and so on. And the thing he really hits the hardest on is two issues. Number one, Gary is very critical of the fact that the essay continually emphasized Joseph Smith as a reluctant polygamist, as this guy that was, there was the angel holding a sword over his head, commanding him to practice polygamy, and that this guy was really, really, you know, he just really was repulsed by the idea that, you know, and he says that that just, you know, that just doesn't ring quite true. He says there's a deliberately playing down of Joseph Smith's the sexuality, the idea that, you know, polygamy was a means of multiplying and replenishing the chosen seed and so on. And the other thing he's critical of is the downplaying of the theological underpinnings, you know, based on the use of DNC 132. And, you know, so and he's also critical of the fact that the most important, some of the most important books are not even cited in the Gospel Topics essay, particularly Lawrence Foster's Religion and Sexuality, George Smith's book, but we call it plural marriage or polygamy, and no mention. He seems to rely, all, you know, very heavily on Brian Hale's extremely apologetic, you know, accounts. That seems to be the primary underpinnings for the essay itself. And so that's kind of how, you know, Bejerra, you know, really does but he does it in a very balanced way. It's a very strong essay. He gives credit where credit's due, but he's not afraid to, you know, point out the weaknesses. And the same is true for George Smith's essay. It kind of some of the similar arguments in the Smith essay, he is particularly critical of the failure to really emphasize the essential nature of polygamy, not just for multiplying and replenishing the earth, but absolutely necessary for ultimate exaltation in the afterlife. That you know, that these you know, that it becomes almost a prerequisite, as you know, as continually cited in DNC 132. George Smith is also critical of the essay tends to downplay the importance of polygamy as it was being practiced at the time, and that it was continually an essential part, an essential doctrine, not just, you know, a practice or an aside to Mormonism, but it was the centrality of the importance of polygamy during that period when it was being practiced, and the ferocity with which it was defended right up until, you know, the very end, right up until 1890. And that's basically George Smith's essay. Now, my essay deals with it deals with kind of the end of the practice, starting with in response to the government anti-polygamous campaign, I give credit to the essay for the way it really discusses how the saints at that time saw it as a deliberate act of civil disobedience. They felt that, you know, they were really torn between, you know, being obedient to the laws of the federal government, but yet this essential practice which was an essential part of Mormonism's superstructure of the time. And I give credit to the essay for its willingness to talk about the limits of the manifesto of 1890, and that the end of the practice, I one of the strongest features I see in the Gospel Topics essay, this essay, is that it carefully points out how the end of the practice was a process rather than a single event, you know, and that, you know, it's not just all of a sudden the manifesto of 1890 ended the practice, and the willingness of the essay to acknowledge post-manifesto marriages that took place after 1890, including one of my ancestors. My great aunt entered into a plural marriage in 1905. Her name was Marion Bringhurst, married a guy by the name of Heber Banyan, who was they were both active practicing Latter-day Saints, but they ended up in this in this plural relationship, which had been written about, in fact, by one of my distant relatives. And it was published actually in BYU Studies, this particular incident of plural marriage. But the weaknesses of the essay, as this essay on, you know, the end of the practice, and I feel that it neglected that one of the major reasons for the abandonment of polygamy was the Mormon push for statehood. They had been denied statehood for decades, you know, ever since the 1850s. They've made repeated efforts to become a state, but they were denied statehood, you know, until 1896 because of the practice of polygamy. And I also, and like the other two authors, like Smith and Bajera, I'm also critical of the fact they make no mention whatsoever of DNC 132, which was absolutely, you know, it's still part of the, you know, it's still church canon, still church doctrine, that particular section of the Doctrine and Covenants. And the truncated discussion, I always take issue with that, the way they kind of handled the church shifting from polygamy to monogamy in church terms of church leaders and the church membership as a whole. There was still, as I maintain, a very strong polygamous strong subculture within Mormonism right up until, you know, into the mid 20th century. In fact, as you're probably aware, Richard Lyman claimed to be practicing polygamy as late as 1943.
And he was an apostle, right?
An apostle. Yeah, he was an apostle. No mention is made of that particular fact. And I also fault them for their limited discussion of the fundamentalist Mormon, the rise of fundamentalist Mormonism. They pass it, I think, with one sentence. But I think it was the church considered the rise of fundamentalist Mormonism, a polygamous Mormonism, as an existential threat. I mean, one of the most vigorous opponents were none other than Heber J. Grant and J. Reuben Clark. In fact, they found it such a threat that as late as 1933, they wrote and issued what was called the Third and Final Manifesto, strongly condemning anybody who practiced polygamy. And I also take fault with the fact that they deliberately omit mentioning authors who have written on these topics. So that's basically the critique or the way that those three essays, Gary, Bajera, George Smith, and mine, handled those respective topics. As I say, it's a three-phase process, you know, Mormon polygamy, we call it the persistence of polygamy, mm-hmm. You know, first under Joseph Smith, and then under Brigham Young through up until the Manifesto of 1890, and then the final phase from 1890 down to the present.
Yeah, and those, I have those books. I can't find them for the moment for some reason, but I know they're great books. And so if anybody wants to check out some amazing books on polygamy that I think are probably still unheralded, those Persistence of Polygamy books I think are fantastic. Now, let me push back a little bit on that for just a moment. And I think one of the goals of the church was to say, hey, we don't want to produce books. And so they did limit these to roughly, let's say, 8 pages or so. I'm not sure if that's right. I know for a fact the race essay, which we'll talk about with Matt here in just a minute, Paul Reeve had written, I think it was a 55-page essay that they distilled down to 8 pages. And I know that Ugo Perego had written, I want to say, 40 pages, Hopefully that's correct. And they distilled it also down to about 8 pages. So let me ask this question with regards to polygamy. So say that again.
What was Ugo's on?
Ugo's was on DNA in the Book of Mormon. So and we'll talk about this with Matt. I know in my interview with Paul Reeve, Paul admitted, and also Elder Snow also mentioned that they went to Paul to write the Race and Priesthood essay. And then Ugo Perego, when I talked with him, had mentioned that he had been asked to do the DNA essay. And we'll talk about that with Thomas Murphy in another interview. And I've heard rumors of who the people were that wrote the polygamy essay. I don't know if you're willing to share that. But at any rate, could it be this editing, you know, if we take a 50-page document and go down to 8 pages, I mean, you're going to lose a lot, obviously, when you do that. And so could it be argued that these weren't intentional, you know, leaving out George Smith, leaving out, I think Compton did get quoted, but some of these other essays, Lawrence Foster, you'd mentioned. Could it be argued that just with the editing process that was unintentional, or do you think it was intentional that some of these polygamy authors were purposely excluded?
Well, I think that there's a real sensitivity there, and Armin Moss kind of brings that up in the postscript essay, that there was a lot of politics and a lot of pressure from above that these authors of these essays were laboring under, that they knew that there was going to have to go through kind of a censorship, because not only do you have to distill it down from, let's say, 50 pages down to 7 or 8 pages in the final document, but you have to be careful about the sources that you're going to cite. And I guess one of the sources that really was deliberately, and I think, and Armin, I think, makes a strong case that there are certain sources that were deliberately left out. And I'm convinced by his argument in that postscript essay, because, you know, Dialogue was almost looked at as being a toxic publication. You know, it has, you know, which is sort of sad, because so much cutting edge scholarship has come through Dialogue, and it has this, maybe toxic is too strong of a word, let's say a highly negative connotation with certain people, along with Sunstone even.
Do you think Elder Oaks was one who started Dialogue? Do you think he would be the one who would be
that's
like,
ironic. It's most ironic, because Oates has really, his politics, his ideology has really shifted, because, you know, as you're well aware, Dallin Oaks was also the co-author with Marvin Hill of that marvelous book, Carthage Conspiracy, which won the MHA Best Book Award back in 1976. They were awarded, it was considered the best book of the year.
It's considered a
piece of cutting edge scholarship. And at that time, Oaks and Hill were very much of the same. You know, it was before Oaks was even president of BYU, and it's interesting. I'd be interested to see what the biography on his life is going to be, because actually I had my close encounter with his family. I dated his daughter-in-law for back in 1963, and I remember meeting Dallin Oaks when he was still at the University of Chicago. I mean, I think back, gosh, I could have been a shirt rail, a shirt tail. I could have been a champion. I could have been a contender, to quote my famous movie actor. I could have been someone, you know, if I'd have married Linda Dixon, whose sister June Dixon was Dallin Oaks' first wife. But I mean, whoever does his biography, I think, you know, to as you say, going from this very liberal, you know, open-minded to you know, this neo-orthodox hard line, you know, I think that's where he stands right now. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get sidelined.
No, sorry. That's funny. That's nice. But so you're saying that Armin Moss does say that the church purposely left out certain authors because they
didn't want certain authors cited. They didn't want certain publications cited. I really think that Armin Moss was. I tend to agree with that because that there's too much of that goes on in so much of Orthodox Mormon scholarship. They're either going to, you know, the more Orthodox writers, the more hardline writers are going to either demean it or just completely ignore it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you agree with me, Matt.
Oh, I was going to say, I concur with that. I've heard from a couple of people who worked on these essays, there were certain authors that were off limits, you could not cite. And there were, I mean, Sunstone and Dialogue has always been in the church as crosshairs. And so it was pretty clear that some of those authors were not to cite those as well. So I don't think this is anything new or dramatic.
No.
I think but you do raise a great question. I think it's an excellent question about the editing process, what was left out. And so when critics or observers or when anyone comments on the Gospel Topics essays, I think it's a fair question to say, did they deliberately leave something out or was it just cut on the cutting room floor? And I think that the answer is there was probably both. Things were left out deliberately, and then there were some things they just didn't want to talk about. I mean, they were already pushing the limits with polyandry and some other controversial things. We just can't go further. And when we talk about my essay in a minute, I can comment about one of the things they just didn't want to talk about. And I'm sure if I talk to Paul and others with knowledge of the process, I mean, they just didn't talk about certain things in the race issue. So anyway, I want to say something that I think needs to be said, which is, this is my opinion, you know, Newell could disagree, other people could disagree, but in some respects, I think the church has done a little bit better in recent years. On the church webpage, they cite my book with Newell on Blacks and Mormons, which is great. They sold our book at Deseret Book, which is, I think, extraordinary. And I'm told that when President Nelson in 2017 or 2018 said that he wanted to get away from using the word Mormon, and I'm told this is secondhand, but I'm told that Deseret Book had to get rid of books on their shelves that had the word Mormon in the title. And so our book, I think, was one of the casualties that left Deseret Bookstores because it's...
You're talking about this book here?
Talking about that book, yeah. So any book with the word Mormon in the title, Deseret Book could no longer sell. Somebody told me that with sort of insider knowledge. Anyway, so I think the church has done a pretty good job, at least a better job in recent years, acknowledging scholarship, whether it's from Dialogue or Sunstone or Signature Books or a university press that might have a critical edge to it. And I think that's to be, transparency is always, always necessary and important. And I think we as authors and writers have a responsibility to be balanced in our tone, to be fair in our criticisms and generous in our praise. And one of the reasons why I like this Gospel Topics book that Newell and I did so much is that I thought that the essayist did a remarkable job praising the church where it needed to be praised and where it should have been praised, and then being a little critical about maybe areas where the church could have been a little bit more transparent. And so I thought the balance was, we struck a pretty good balance that in this book, and Newell and I were extremely careful to select writers that we thought that didn't have an axe to grind, that, you know, we just weren't interested in that. And without going into details, because I don't want to do this, but there were a few writers that wrote pieces that we turned away because we thought they were just way too critical. And in one case, one of the writers didn't want to make the edits that Newell and I suggested. So we just said, we can't work with you. And then the other essays, we couldn't fix it. And those three essays just didn't give us the quality and the tone that we wanted. So we had to drop them and move on. So anyway, we were very sensitive to tone. And I think that no matter what you write on, whether it's Mormon history or Catholic history or any history for that matter, we should always try to find some kind of sympathy with our readers and try to find a tone that would be approachable. And I think we owe it to the people that we write about. And so
Well, yeah, and that's great. I'm glad you mentioned that, and because I was curious about authors that may not have made the cut. But just one final thing on polygamy, Newell, if I can ask you this. As you know, we've talked a little bit about the weaknesses, but would you say that these, especially these three essays on polygamy, are, you know, to paraphrase the moonwalk, one large step for mankind, or one large step for the church in acknowledging all of this stuff? Because personally, I think they're pretty groundbreaking in the stuff, especially the polyandry stuff that was acknowledged. Can you talk about that? I mean, isn't this pretty amazing what the church has done?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they were willing to have three essays on polygamy is remarkable in and of itself, because that's always, you know, it's almost like a tacit acknowledgement of the centrality that the practice had throughout the early history of the church up until the late 19th, early 20th century. That the fact that they allowed for three essays and not just one and tried to, you know, cram everything into a single essay, I think that in and of itself is a strong acknowledgement. And then, as I say, the certain details that were brought out in the essays itself, the polyandry, the younger, you know, a marriage of younger girls, you know, teenagers, you know, and just the acknowledgement of the centrality of the importance in 19th century Mormon society, and what a painful adjustment it was, not only for those who were practicing polygamy, but conversely, the painful adjustment when it came time to abandon the practice in the 1890s. I mean, and a lot of that has made its way into the second volume of Saints, which I just got through reading. I was surprised at the remarkable frankness with which polygamy is handled in that second volume, which I just read. So, you know, that's kind of a manifestation or a consequence, I think, of what was the path-breaking work that was done in the three polygamist gospel topics essays.
Yeah. Well, I know some people have still been critical of both Saints Volume 1 and Saints Volume 2 as not going far enough. But I really think how far they've gone is leaps and bounds better than what we've ever had in the past.
I heartily agree with that.
Yeah. Well, great.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Matt Harris and Dr. Newell Bringhurst. In our next conversation, we're going to move on to the topic of racism. Newell will tell us what he finds absent in some of the essays.
The inherent aspects of Mormon racism as articulated in Mormon scripture is nowhere even mentioned or discussed in the race and priesthood essay.
For those of you who are interested in the entire interview uncut without any interruptions, sign up at patreon.com/gospeltangents and you can hear the entire interview for just $5 a month. Also, we have other tiers. If you'd like to subscribe on our website at gospeltangents.com, click on the yellow subscribe button and you can subscribe for $10. You can also do that on Patreon and get a PDF transcript. We've also got some other ones for $15 and $20 if you'd like to get those as well. If you're interested in individual transcripts, go to Amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents interview, and you can see our past interviews there in paperback form. So just check out Gospel Tangents. We're always updating those. For the latest updates on Facebook, go to Facebook.com/Gospel Tangents, and you can see our latest updates there. We're also on Twitter at Gospel Tangents. Of course, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. And please give us a 5-star rating for those of you who listen to audio only. So once again, thanks for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again.